Six music.
BBC Radio. Six Music Documentaries.
I'm Matt Everett and welcome to a new series of The First Time on Six Music. This is the show where we speak to some of music's most loved and influential figures about the pivotal first moments that shaped their lives and their careers. Today's guests made up half and then two-thirds of a band who helped bring American alternative music from post-punk and indie clubs into the mainstream and stadiums. After 15 albums and 31 years together, they split on September the 21st, 2011, but left behind an amazing legacy. They managed to achieve worldwide recognition while also maintaining their status as one of the most enigmatic and interesting bands in rock music. My guests on The First Time this week are from REM, Michael Stipe and Mike Mills. Here, Michael and Mike look back on their very earliest influences, the bands that made an impact on the formative REM in Athens, Georgia, and their recollections of their very first gig, first release, and first TV performance. With the benefit of hindsight, we also look back on the recording and impact of some of their albums, from the groundbreaking 80s releases Murmur and Reckoning, to the flawless run of Green, Out of Time, and Automatic for the People. We also talk about the moment they decided to end the band. We also discover what happened the first time Stipe met Bowie, and we get some beard maintenance tips along the way. But I started by asking Michael and Mike, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time they were aware of music.
I had a little transistor radio that a gas station gave away, and I listened to it constantly, even under my pillow at night in bed. That was back when Top 40 Radio in America would play everything, all types of music. There was no formatting, so that's the first thing I remember was probably the Beatles, listening to them.
Which track would you listen to under your pillow?
Well, the one that stuck in my head was I Want to Hold Your Hand, so that was early.
Mine was when I lived in Germany, and I was probably 7 years old, and I was visiting a German friend, and Michel Maybel by the Beatles was playing on the radio in German or French. I'm not sure which language.
Michel Maybel, c'est toujours ainsi que je t'appelle, ma Michel.
Standing looking at the radio, it was very short, standing looking at the radio and wondering like what that was coming out of it.
Just instantly both fascinated by sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about first album?
From Germany, my family moved to Texas, and friendly old Mr. Pemberton, the owner of the record store in our very small town, offered my sisters and I a couple of singles that he had laying around for free as gifts. When our grandmother took us in to buy, she gave us money to buy two albums. We bought Double Trouble by Elvis Presley.
Good record.
Soundtrack. I can still sing most of the songs on it. And The Parent Trap featuring Haley Mills. So we had Disney and Elvis. And kindly old Mr. Pemberton gave us King of the Road by Roger Miller, the guy who wrote it. I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles. And D-I-V-O-R-C-E by Tammy Wynette. 45s.
Our little boy is 4 years old. And quite a little man. So we spell out the words we don't want him to understand. Like T-O-Y or maybe S-U-R-P-R-I-S-E. But the words we're hiding from him now tear the heart right out of me. Our D-I-V-O-R-C-E becomes final today. Me and little J-O-D will be going away. I love you both, and this will be pure H-E-double-L for me.
First ones I remember listening to, my mother listened to Joan Baez a lot, so that was one. And then parents of a certain age in the 60s, they all, there was a certain thing in the culture that, for example, they all had fondue kits.
Yeah, I remember that.
And they all listened to, a lot of them listened to the Limelighters, which was a folk group that was slightly more cutting edge than the Kingston Trio, slightly naughtier and a lot more fun than that. And then there was an odd record called The First Family. It was at the time the biggest selling record, the fastest selling record in America, was by a comedian named Vaughn Meader, and they basically made fun of the Kennedys in a very friendly, lighthearted way. So it was a parody record about the Kennedy family.
I noticed that you didn't touch your salad either at dinner tonight or at dinner last night. Would you tell us why, please?
Well, let me say this about that. Now, number one, in my opinion, the fault does not lie as much with the salad as it does with the dressing being used on the salad. Now, let me say that I have nothing against the dairy industry. However, I would prefer it if in the future we stuck to coleslaw. Next.
Already you've got kind of like ballads and pop and politics and folk. This is the DNA of REM here, basically, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Weirdly, yeah.
What about the first show, the first gig you went to that really made an impact and kind of made you feel that's maybe what I want to do?
I saw the Ramones perform at a small club, not much bigger than this room.
Wow, where was that?
Edwardsville, Illinois. I had then moved on to another part of the country, and they played, I think it was 1977, and I might have been 78, but they played a small club with the Runaways opening, and I took my father's camera and took photographs and was blown away by the music.
What else do you remember from that show?
Joan Jett jumped off stage. She had taken some Quaaludes, as it turns out, and she jumped off stage to dance with the audience, and she landed on top of me.
You physically had that connection?
We fell together, and I told her about that years later.
1, 2, 3, 4.
First artist to jump on you then at a young age?
They shall remain nameless. The first show I remember going to see, you know, I lived in Macon, Georgia. They didn't get a whole lot of, there weren't any small clubs, small bands to see. I saw the Edgar Winter Band with Rick Derringer on guitar and the James Gang opening with Joe Walsh. So that was, you know, as far as 1975 goes, it's not a bad way to start things off. Rick Derringer had, and the bass player too, for Edgar Winter, whose name escapes me, unfortunately.
Bodies. Why would it matter?
Our EM is no longer together.
I know who the first person to jump on you was.
They had their guitars sewn into their one-piece jumpsuits.
What?
Yes, it was all part of their bodysuit. And I remember thinking that even then that was kind of strange, but at least you can't drop it. So
that's the phenomenal. Why has no one done that since? That sounds like the best thing ever.
I think if you could see pictures of it, you'd know why no one does it. But the idea was solid. I like it.
Another first. What were your first impressions, if you can remember, your first impressions of each other?
Oh, God.
That's a good reaction.
I don't think I was as drunk as you think I was when we met, but it's possible.
How much should I tell?
I think you should say everything, Michael.
But I need permission.
Well, if it's just about, you know, being late at night and drinking, that's one thing.
He was such a nerd.
Well, of course I was a nerd. I was a total nerd.
And I
had
like,
bell bottoms.
I do not want to be in a band with that
I was
that
wearing
nerd.
Bell bottoms in 1978 or 79. Well, I lived in Macon for, you know, 8 years. And in Macon, Georgia, bell bottoms were still the height of fashion.
Yeah.
And those were the only pants I had. So when I came to college, that's what I wore. And it took me a while to get more pants.
It's not like I was the coolest thing, you know,
yeah, I was gonna
on
say,
the block, but I thought I was.
The other way around, what were your first impressions of him?
didn't have any. My first impression of Michael that I really recall was the first rehearsal that Bill and I did with Michael and Peter. And Bill and I had a couple of songs that we'd written with the band we were in Macon. And I remember we showed them to Peter and Michael, and what those two guys did with those songs just blew me away. It was completely unexpected and completely cooler than anything we had done with them in Macon. And I said, okay, this is something I can work with.
That's a nice answer.
And it's true. It's quite true.
In 1980, the first ever kind of REM gig, although you weren't called REM at the time, at the church in Athens. Mm-hmm. It's become like a legendary event now. You know, people talk about it as being this sort of moment, I don't know, the flashpoint for the band to kind of begin the party that you staged. Was it actually any good? And what can you remember from that first show?
It was spirited. other than that, no, it wasn't probably very good.
What can you recall from it?
It was very punk rock. I mean, it was, you know, a bunch of people threw a party and got really hammered and jumped around and slept with each other and got more hammered and
I think it was
woke up and regretted it.
One reason it was so great is because we were pretty fearless about what we did. I mean, we had a few of our own songs. We had a lot of covers, and when those ran out, we just started playing things we didn't know. We didn't have to play them well to make the audience happy at that point. So I think it was just the fact that we would do anything that popped into our heads was one of the things that made it a little more unusual than other parties.
The myth is that after that first show, every time you played, you'd sort of gather this audience, and it seemed you made a connection very, very quickly with the public.
I mean, the real punk rockers in our small town didn't like us very much because we brought a larger crowd of people than any other punk rock band. And we brought people that they didn't really like that much.
Why?
Why did they not like them? Because they were like frat boys, you know, like really super square, not cool people. But they liked REM. So we got more attention, I guess, than the other bands. And they were a little resentful of that.
A lot of the bands in Athens at that time were art projects. They were people who weren't musicians who had chosen to use music as their expression of art.
And one of those art bands turned out to be, you know, collectively most influential, one of the most influential bands on us, which is the band Pylon.
If we were to play a Pylon track at this point in the show, what would it be?
Volume. It just had this immense power. Tour with the Gang of Four, and then we wound up going on tour with the Gang of Four thanks to them. And the Gang of Four were this amazing band, as we know, and even more so live. Pylon took more than a few pages from the Gang of Four after their tour, and then we took more than a few pages from the Gang of Four after our tour. So there's that. Paralyzed by the Gang of Four, one of the greatest songs ever written.
Blinker. Flat on my back. They say our world is built with endeavor, that every man is for himself. Wealth is for the one that wants it. Paradise, if you can earn it. This is the reason. I'm washed up. ambitions come to nothing. What I wanted now seems just a waste of time. I can't make out what has gone wrong. I was good at what I did. The crows come home to roost, and I'm the Duke.
What can you remember from your first US TV appearance, which was Letterman, which was 83?
Okay.
What was that?
I said goddamn is what I said. What I remember is that they told us that after we played our song, David Letterman would walk over and he would speak to one member of the band. Who should he speak to? And everyone went, Peter. So Peter was designated as the guy who would speak to David Letterman. So we play our song. We did fine. We were nervous. David Letterman starts to walk over, and I sat down. I didn't know the first thing about television. I know now that my frame ends about here, right? So I can gesture, and it means so much more, and I can look directly into camera, and it means a lot. But at the time, I knew nothing. I sat down so David Letterman could talk to Peter. I didn't know that he was reaching to shake my hand. And I didn't know that by sitting down, I dropped out of frame like a Muppet. So I became instantly the eccentric artist.
And that was the moment
where I became the enigma. And the word enigma has followed me to this day. So that's why I say goddamn when I think about the David Letterman show.
When did you first feel famous? Good blank reaction like that.
No, age. I mean, I don't want to lie. Age 5.
Really?
Why not?
Was you just waiting for the rest of the world to catch up with it?
They took their time, but here we sit. Yeah, no, I mean, I wanted to be famous since I was a teenager. I'm not sure why, but it seemed like the thing to do. And, well, it worked. But obviously the reality of fame has nothing at all in common with the fantasy of fame. And so I followed my teenage dreams quite naively. And worked very hard, and I found the right people to work with, and it worked. And I don't know that I'm a great public figure, but I'm pretty proud of who I became, and I'm pretty okay with who I am today.
Yeah.
So I think I probably might have come through it okay.
You survived it.
Yeah.
This is The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guests Michael Stipe and Mike Mills from REM. And that was Superman by REM from their 1986 album Life's Rich Pageant, originally written in 1969 by the Texan band The Clique.
BBC Radio.
BBC Radio.
6 Music.
Distance.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, the show where we look back at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guests this week are Michael Stipe and Mike Mills from REM. And that was, of course, Losing My Religion. That was the first single from the group's 1991 album Out of Time, which would be REM's first US and UK number one, helped in part by the brilliant video for Losing My Religion, which got very heavy rotation on MTV at the time. So how did the band's world change at that point?
It was exponential for me in terms of how many people on the street recognized me suddenly. That just went from 4% to 98%. So I became a face.
Because you were actually in that video. Mm-hmm. We weren't in a lot of hours.
And there was very, that emotional,
very upfront, you know, yeah.
There's that thing that happens when you connect to something mm-hmm. or someone and they're playing a part, and there's a very real connection. So that happened with Losing My Religion.
Mm-hmm. How did you deal with the attention? Do you think you dealt with it well in hindsight?
Yeah, we had. It was a slow burn for us, so I had a decade to get used to the idea of it. And at that point, I was pretty grounded.
Because you get that point that you sort of entered, you know, with the albums, album before, Out of Time, sort of going through. When I spoke to another musician about it once who had a couple of very big records, lucky enough to have some very big records, and they say, it's a strange thing, that it's almost like you're kind of plated in gold for a while, and it's like you can do nothing wrong, and everything seems to happen right for you, and it sits, every camera turns to you, and it all goes perfectly for a while. Did you experience that? Because creatively, it seemed like you were on this amazing path when everything you did made such an impact.
We had that for about 14 years. I mean, we made all the right decisions, and our popularity growth was so gradual until it became exponential with Out of Time, but it was so gradual before then that clearly the decisions we were making and the songs that we were writing and the shows that we were playing were working. And we got surprisingly good critical reviews for most of the time, and so we felt like whatever we were doing, we should keep it going because it was working.
I think you can feel when you're on an upswing. But my art teacher at college, when I was 19 and 20, James Herbert, said to us, you're only as good as your last painting. And so, however big Losing My Religion was, or whatever song followed it, we had no guarantee that that was going to continue on an upward trajectory. We had no idea that it was going to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and then eventually start getting not as big. All those things that happened.
I don't know why you mean to me.
What was Warner Brothers' reaction when you first delivered New Adventures in Hi-Fi? Because it was a very big record, but it was coming off the back of much more accessible albums. Were Warners kind of freaked out?
I don't remember.
I don't remember them being freaked out. I think, you know, that by that point they were used to us making weird turns. You know, we'd gone from Green to Out of Time to Automatic for the People to Monster.
One of the reasons we signed with Warner Brothers to begin with is because they had signed Neil Young, who everyone in the band was a giant fan of. And Neil Young would go off and do these records that were completely, like him stretching, really pushing himself, completely stylistically different from what he's known for. And the record companies seemed to be quite supportive of that, and we were impressed by that. So New Adventures in Hi-Fi, I remember everything about it, but I do not remember the record company's reaction to it. It's my favorite album of our entire career.
Why is that?
It's a great record. You know what? I don't even like rock music. Let it be said. But it's a great rock record. And it captures, and how could we have known it at the time, but it captures a band at their absolute peak as a four-piece. And Bill left after we released it.
Your eyes are burning holes through me. I'm gasoline. Century goes to sleep.
Was it difficult to maintain the ethos that you had when you started, when you got that big as some of these records made you? Because regardless of how you are as people, logistically and practically, your world changes. You know, one, the venues require a certain infrastructure. Your lives change.
Well, they can. Peter Buck was very instrumental in keeping us on course. Because he was such a rock historian, he knew the things that could trip you up. He knew that getting indulgent and lazy and slow would be harmful. So Peter was always the one that as soon as we put a record out, he's like, okay, we need to start rehearsing on the next one. Let's start writing songs. Let's keep it going. And that's how New Adventures came around, because he said, well, we're going to be on the road for a year doing the Monster Tour. We should write and record the next record while we're doing that. And so virtually all of that was done.
Except for me.
Oh, except for you. But well, then musically, we were at soundcheck every day for an hour and a half, writing and playing most of the songs that became the next record.
Yeah. The only thing I managed to write was a chorus. I mean, when we're on tour, when we're performing live, it's impossible for me to do anything but focus on that. And so they were rehearsing every day. But I came up with the chorus to Leave. Is that it? It's a really great lyric.
I thought it was Departure, but maybe...
Departure I wrote in one sitting in San Sebastian after we flew there from Singapore, and it was about River dying. Mm.
But that was on tour, nonetheless.
That was on tour. Yeah, you're right. Actually, in fact, you're right. So I wrote Departure. Okay, I feel a little better.
Come on.
When was the first morning you were like, you know, I'm not going to have a shave? And then, you know, maybe I'll just keep it going because it's looking good. It's looking good. Was there a conscious moment or did it just kind of happen?
I went three Halloweens ago. I went as a failed radical fairy. And to be a failed radical fairy, you have to have a lot of facial hair. Put flowers in it. Way too much glitter, way too much makeup, overdo the eyebrows. And it worked. People laughed and laughed and laughed. And I had a great Halloween. By the time the next Halloween had come around, my father died. And I was in mourning. And I'd never had a beard before. So I started growing it for the second year of being a failed radical fairy for Halloween. And then I just kept it going. And at some point, it became ridiculous.
Do you use much product on it? Or is it pretty natural?
Are you really asking me that?
I'm really asking you that, yeah.
Okay. I wash it with shampoo. I've tried conditioner, but it doesn't condition very well. I'm kind of going for, rather than Skid Row Santa, I'm kind of going for like a Poseidon / Zeus / Brancusi Matisse kind of appeal. And so I keep it a little trimmed on the sides to show off my beautiful cheekbones. And that's about it, really. I put some oil on it from time to time.
Another question I want to ask was your first impressions upon meeting David Bowie.
We met David Bowie for the first time in Switzerland in 1995 when Bill Berry had an aneurysm on stage. He'd gone in for surgery and he was in hospital repairing. And Claude Knobs was the guy who started
Montreux Jazz Festival.
And he invited us to dinner. We came to dinner at his house. He had flown in a band to perform from somewhere and a chef to cook from somewhere else, I think from Ireland. And upon arriving at his beautiful home, he said, a few people are going to be joining us tonight, including David Bowie.
No, he said, I think David might be joining us for dinner. We're like, oh, David, great. Who's David?
I said, I need to take a nap. And I went upstairs. We were on tour, and our adrenaline, you know, is through the roof. You're performing. And suddenly, we have this cold stop because of Bill. And we're suddenly stuck in Switzerland waiting for him to live or die. And he lived, and everything's great. But it was a really tense moment. And we were all completely adrenalized and kind of still on tour, but in complete standstill. I went upstairs and took a nap. And at whatever point, someone in the house came and woke me up and said, Mr. Bowie has arrived and dinner is served. I said, I need three espressos, please. And it took three espressos for me to walk down the stairs and look David Bowie in the eye and say, how do you do? It's nice to meet you finally.
And was it as pleasant as most people say meeting him was?
He did not stop talking for 3 hours.
He was great.
Unbelievable. He was so engaging, so funny,
fascinated
so
about
smart.
The upcoming millennium. And he had opinions on why there was so much body modification going on among young people. He felt that they were suffering millennial angst, even though they weren't aware of it. He was really convinced that people were getting all the tattoos and the piercings because of the upcoming century change, and it was having some sort of psychological effect on them.
He had a book with a bunch of his artwork in it, original artwork. He had miniatures of sculptures that he had been working on with him. He had a photograph of James Dean as a teenager naked in a tree. And he was just fascinating. I mean, everything you would expect from David Bowie times 10. That was the first time we met him.
What's the Bowie track we should play at this point for you?
Well, I mean, Ashes to Ashes is one of the greatest songs ever written.
Diamond and
When was the point when you first thought, as a band, our work here is done? And who was the first person to table the motion, I guess is one way of putting it?
I think we all came to the realization probably during the 08 tour. I remember the last show was in Mexico City, and I remember going out on the stage by myself after it was over, walking around just thinking, well, I'll probably never do this again.
Really?
Yeah. And then sometime after that, we had a meeting, and I don't remember who said it first, but we all went, yeah, I think that's the right idea.
In fact, we changed the tour so that we ended somewhere that we all kind of liked, and we decided Mexico City would be a great last place to perform if, in fact, we were going to carry through with it.
Because obviously it's something that you've been asked about a lot since you broke up, but it's an enormously emotional decision to make. It's not something, it's families, people say bands like a family a lot, but to build up to making that decision rather than just one person going, you know what, I want to stop, and going, no, this would be great, we can make something, oh, here's a new song, okay, I've changed your mind. It's very different to everyone drawing what is a full stop under it. How hard was it to make that decision?
Well, it was incredibly difficult, but it would have been a lot harder had we not all felt that it was time. I mean, nobody had to be dragged kicking and screaming into this. We all sort of looked at each other and said, yeah, I was already thinking that. There's so many reasons behind it, but one of the ones is we broke up through no ill external influences. We broke up because we wanted to. We broke up because we were still friends. We wanted to remain friends. We wanted to go while we were young enough and have more fun doing other things and continue to have dinners together. And, you know, that was.
And we created this beautiful thing, and I've said it a million times, I'll say it again. We own the triumphs and we own the disastrous failures of our 32 years together. But it's this beautiful thing called REM, and for me it was really important that the legacy remain intact. And the only way to really do that and to do it properly would be for all of us to agree that it was time to just stop, and then to agree that we will never, for any reason, come back together. We will not be the band that does that. And I don't see any good reason for us to ever perform together again as REM. In Mexico City, and you can see it's still difficult for us to talk about in a way. It's a very emotional thing, but as we performed the encore, Peter walked over and said, before Man on the Moon, he said, I think this is the last time, right? And I said, yeah, that's it. If you believe, they put a man on the moon. If you believe, there's nothing up his sleeve, and nothing is cool.
What do you miss most about it?
Very little. I mean, we literally accomplished everything we wanted to.
You miss performing. I miss performing.
Well, I get to play. I miss playing with you and Peter and Bill. I do definitely miss that aspect of it, playing our songs together. Yes, I miss that. But I'm on stage with a lot of different people a lot of different times. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, getting to play for people is still fun. Getting to play our songs with each other, of course, we'll always miss that.
I miss writing. I'm very shy to write with other people because I really felt like I am really a one-trick pony. If I don't have Mike and Peter, or Mike, Peter, and Bill behind me or next to me, I don't know that I can do what I do. So I'm still not sure that I can do it, but I'm going to try. I started accidentally a couple, 2 years ago. Casey Spooner from the band Fisher Spooner invited me into their studio. He had a problem with a song, and he said, would you come listen to this and see what you think? And I wound up actually producing the entire album and co-writing it. So I was able to write through someone else's character and voice, and that was a unexpected and thrilling way for me to kind of step back into music and writing.
And after all these firsts, we have the last thing, which is the last track. What should we end on?
What about, what's the one that we loved? Harlem Nocturne. That's a beautiful one by the
sure.
Viscounts.
Sure.
Harlem Nocturne by the Viscounts. Viscounts.
Beautifully done.
Good luck finding it.
Good to speak to you. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you. Very
thank
much.
You.
Thank
you. We'll be right back.
is BBC Radio 6 Music. Right now.
This is the Morning After Mix.
You're about to hear a shortened version of the Morning After Mix, a carefully curated playlist available in the BBC Sounds app. It's full of gentle songs for when you need a musical rescue or escape. To find the full version, just search Morning After in the app. But for now, enjoy the calm.
Stay on my shore.